welcome. You're watching The Buck Stops Here, and I'm Barkha Dutt. In perhaps its strongest words about Pakistan so far, India has lashed out after Pakistan's Nawaz Sharif addressed the United Nations General Assembly. India said what was once the land of Taxila has now become the Ivy League of terrorism. India went on to perhaps for the first time describe Pakistan as a terror state and said that the world was feeling the toxic effects of Pakistan's toxic curriculum. Pakistan's terror state, it said, carries out war crimes. These are perhaps the strongest words that have been used by India for Pakistan at a fora like the United Nations General Assembly. This was just hours after Nawaz Sharif addressed the United Nations General Assembly. In a speech that seemed to have scored a virtual self-goal while exposing Pakistan's open endorsement for terrorism. Take a look at the man that Nawaz Sharif was calling a young leader. This is Burhan Wani, and let's just stay on that for a bit. This is an excerpt from one of Burhan Wani's many videos before he was killed. We are deliberately not playing the audio of what he said on this video clip to not give it undue publicity, but these operative words are important. In this video clip, which is how Burhan Wani used to address his supporters when he was in hiding, Burhan Wani calls for young Kashmiris to pick up the gun. He says they must join jihad if they want to see an Islamic caliphate in Kashmir, and then goes on to talk about how this could become a struggle for a global caliphate. Nawaz Sharif called this man a young hero. A hero, in his words, a militant, a terrorist who called for the caliphate to come to Kashmir. What else has Burhan Wani been saying in his videos before he was killed? An open death threat to Kashmiris who may consider joining the police force in particular. Threats to the media as well in this video. Burhan Wani openly asking the media to fall in line or else, and telling Kashmiris that police officers, you are our own people. You cannot fight on the side of traitors, and if you do, the punishment will be death. These are violent threats of an armed militant. As you can see, those are actual original pictures from one of his videos. Yet Prime Minister Sharif said that this was a man who believed in peaceful protest. So that juxtaposition tells us everything. And it tells us that Nawaz Sharif was not interested in de-escalating tensions. It also tells us, therefore, that we have hit a diplomatic dead end. And it begs the question, what can, will and should India do next? Now, one of the suggestions that has been on the table, and it was made by a BJP leader himself today in the Indian Express, Yashwant Sinha, if we can just bring up those graphics now, was to look at water as a possible weapon of war. Water as a weapon in modern conflicts where other military options may have consequences that a country may not want. A suggestion that the Indus Water Treaty, which by the way has stood the test of time, even through three full-blown wars between India and Pakistan, could be abrogated. This, some have started arguing, could hurt the Pakistanis where it matters the most and could in fact cause droughts and famines if India actually ever does this. But is there a moral imperative to it that India needs to reflect on? This is one of the options that has now been put in the public domain after Nawaz Sharif's open endorsement of terrorism at the United Nations General Assembly. So let's go straight now to our panel tonight. Joining us on the program, with me in the studio, Ambassador G. Parthasarathy, one of our best-known diplomats. We're also joined by Air Chief Marshal Fali Major, who's of course the former Chief of Air Staff, Sanjay Baru, who's an author, commentator, former media advisor to Dr. Manmohan Singh. We're joined by Congress Member of Parliament Shashi Tharoor and Sudhanshu Trivedi of the BJP. Let me get first a quick comments from the politicians. Sudhanshu Trivedi, in some ways, the door for diplomacy, if it was ever open after the Uri terror attack, has been closed. Nawaz Sharif has not used the opportunity to de-escalate at all. He did not make a mention of Uri. He did not even do a kind of token condemnation of violence. Instead, he openly endorsed Burhan Wani. Where does this leave options for India? We have not yet seen diplomatic options fully exercised. We have only seen a summoning of the envoy. Yet, people in the government repeatedly tell us, on background at least, that diplomatic measures this time are not sufficient to address public anger. What is the party thinking? What is the government thinking?
Definitely, this time, look at the level of incidence. Only diplomatic measures are not enough. So we are working on both the diplomatic and the strategic aspect. As far as Pakistan is concerned, their false cry on Kashmir is not going to suffice. The reason being, if they just try to justify the terror attacks in India, whether it is Uri, Pathankot or previous 26-11 with some sort of conflict with India relating to Kashmir, but I would like to ask, if they are seen involved in Dhaka, is this because of the Kashmir? If they are seen involved in Kabul in the Hazara attack, it is because of the Kashmir. If the Pakistanis are found in Sydney attack, it is because of Kashmir. If Britain says that 80% of the terrorists in Britain are related to Pakistan, is it because of Kashmir? If Osama bin Laden is found there, it is because of Kashmir. No, the fact of the matter is Pakistan has now become the terror capital of India. In contrast, what India is now emerging as the intellectual capital, and they are terror capital.
Okay.
So in my opinion,
yes,
on the diplomatic level, we have to put this aspect. And on the strategic level, our military leaders and the political leaders will decide upon what is to be done at what time.
But the point is that while we have been told that the military has been given a free hand to determine an appropriate response, and we have been told that and reporting it over the last 48 hours, clearly, Shashi, we are now seeing a diplomatic dead end. I think if Nawaz Sharif had a little crack in the window open to somehow de-escalate tensions, he did exactly the opposite of that. But that also gives you a sense into the Pakistani mindset. It also tells you that while we seek to isolate them on global fora, they are carrying on, perhaps with the hope that the Chinese will continue to stand by them if nobody else. Where does this leave India's options? We are now looking at talk of scrapping the Indus Water Treaty, withdrawing the MFN status to Pakistan, and so on. Where do you see the options?
Well, certainly, I think that you're quite right that there's not much point in talking to Mr. Nawaz Sharif anymore. He clearly has, in the domestic equation with his all-powerful military, he has decided to surrender to them. It's very clear that he's going to now continue carrying out this kind of policy of intransigence and defense of the indefensible. And I don't think we're going to get any joy in any dialogue with that government, civilian or military. As far as Yashwant Sinha's suggestion of abrogating the Indus Waters Treaty, there I would not agree, respectfully. I suspect that it will do us far more harm than good, not only on moral grounds, as you said, but also on legal grounds. We are a very responsible player in international law. There are a whole number of treaties around the world we expect others to adhere to. We certainly don't want to set an example of violating such a treaty. And least of all, do we want to give a suggestion that the Chinese might want to take advantage of the absence of a treaty to use water against us since we are downstream from them. I think that the big mistake would be in declaring war on the Pakistani people. Our quarrel is not with the Pakistani people, and they would be the victims of abrogating the treaty. Without water, as you said, famine and drought would follow. It would be a disaster for human beings who've done us no harm. The people who are doing us harm are the military, the ISI, the malign infrastructure of terrorism we've been talking about for years, and a complacent civilian government that is unable or unwilling to control these elements. So our actions must be targeted against them. And there I certainly hope that what Mr. Sudhanshu Trivedi was hinting about, which are not presumably issues we can discuss meaningfully on television, are being contemplated with all due seriousness, because it's clearly time for the Indian public to see that when Pakistan continues to poke us like this, it is not with impunity, that there is a price to be paid, and that price must be paid on the other side. But not, it seems to me, by millions of innocent people being deprived of water.
So you do not see using water as a weapon either morally or legally tenable, Shashi? That's what you're saying, that water of all things cannot be converted into a weapon of water.
I don't think it's necessary. I mean, you know, when we had 166 people killed in Mumbai over a protracted four-day terrorist assault, we have shown great restraint. Now we've lost 18 people, they're soldiers, combatants who have laid down their lives. I think we need to honor their memory by acting in a way that honors their sacrifice, showing certainly that we cannot indefinitely show restraint, but at the same time not going to extremes that we didn't even contemplate when we lost 10 times the number of people that we lost 2 days ago.
So let me open this up. Ambassador Partha Sarathy, I would tend to say that Shashi has a point, because any abrogation of a water treaty is actually becomes a humanitarian argument. It becomes a different argument. But there are also those who could say that, you know, we have, any conflict has to be below the nuclear threshold, and if it's below the nuclear threshold, then how much can you contain it, how much can you isolate it, and if limited conflicts are no longer possible for the times we live in, then a Yashwant Sinha kind of argument kicks in, that if that is not possible, then this is.
Look at the situation today, and I'll broadly go along with Shashi Tharoor. The fact of the matter is that if I was today studying the reactions across the world, Barkha, we have Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates speaking on behalf of us. Okay, you have Russia coming up, which everyone was getting doubtful because of closer links with China, come out much stronger than the Americans. You had the Chinese being restrained by their standards, but certainly not seeking to pour oil. And let me just say this.
Well, still describing Pakistan as a victim of terrorism, still promising to stand with them
on international fora. Not the original statement.
The one as presented by the Pakistan media.
As presented by the Pakistani media. And I go by the original statement. Look, don't forget, the Chinese don't want to be dragged into conflicts which they are not going to like to be involved in. When I was High Commissioner Ambassador in Pakistan, I met the Chinese ambassador regularly during Kargil. He came and met me, and the Chinese did not cause us any problems. We are not going to fight an all-out war with Pakistan, but we are certainly going to put the squeeze. Okay?
How? I understand, as Shashi said, we can't deconstruct that on 60 minutes of television.
I have to put it into a diplomatic context.
Yes.
Now, therefore, I am prepared to turn the squeeze on Pakistan, and I have no qualms about whom it hurts there.
Yeah.
It's for the people to topple the government, not for us.
Are against abrogating the
I'm
treaty.
Again for the simple reason.
Yes.
That firstly, under the treaty, they are entitled to the Indus, Jhelum and Chenab.
Yes.
We are entitled to Ravi, Bias and Sutlej. Firstly, why are we allowing Ravi, Bias and Sutlej waters to flow to them? First, deal with first things first. Second, it is not a bilateral treaty. It is a treaty which imposes, has a World Bank presence in it,
yes,
with automatic provisions to go to the UN.
Yeah.
So, you know, we should be careful. When you are having the world's goodwill, don't get doing things which will land you in a mess. And how will you justify to the Arab world that you are starving Muslim people? You know, so let us be real. The real pressure, if you ask me, Barkha, is what we are moving towards, I think, isolating and finally throwing out Pakistan from SAARC. That is real diplomatic pressure. They are isolated in the region. We can do it. We've got Bangladesh and Afghanistan with us. The others have been sending us. I've seen each one of the letters from heads of government, very, very clearly supportive. So let's go step by step. Throw them out of SAARC. But at the same time, I'm a firm believer in covert pressures. I won't go into details.
Okay.
But with three provinces of Pakistan fighting the army, let's squeeze the hell out of them.
Before I get Shashi and Sudhanshu to come back into that, Sanjay Baru, as someone who has been previously in government, and you have seen how governments actually struggle. And the struggle really is this. You have to acknowledge public anger after a terror attack. You have to assert yourself as a strong state. But you also have to be smart. You can't be knee-jerk. You can't let primetime warriors define strategy with Pakistan. How limited are our options today? What are the options within which we can explore asserting strength?
Well, first of all, I think our options are not limited. I think the fact is that compared to even 10 years back, or compared to even 5 years back, the position that we are in is a much stronger position in terms of international opinion. I think there's a growing recognition, as Sudhanshu Trivedi just said, you know, Pakistan is, you know, Kashmir is not responsible for Osama bin Laden being in Islamabad, etc., etc.
And with Nawaz's open endorsement of an armed militant,
exactly,
of a terrorist,
and
saying he's
earlier.
A peaceful young leader,
yeah.
I don't think the world would have an appetite for someone who calls for a caliphate to be imposed.
So the environment
today
has changed, and that too with ISIS, etc.
Yes.
The environment has changed.
Yes.
And that environment globally, favors us.
Yes.
But I think there are several other measures we can take, we have not taken, short of, you know, abrogating treaties. I agree with Shashi and Mr. Parsarthi on Indus Water. For example, most favored nation treaty.
Yes.
which is one of the recommendations, I think, Yashwant Sinha ji
makes
in his article. We have been waiting for Pakistan
to reciprocate
to meet its obligations under the World Trade Organization. Yeah. Why should we adhere to our obligations? No, it will hurt Indian business interests. That's okay. I think there's some price we also have to pay. But the other thing, SAARC, I mean, forget about whether Pakistan is eventually thrown out of SAARC or not. But I don't think we should have the SAARC summit this year. And I think, you know, there is enough public opinion in South Asia, across the region, that you cannot go to Pakistan.
So postpone the SAARC summit?
So there are lots of
ways. Or get these countries to boycott it. Postpone or boycott?
Indefinite postponement, I would say, is the easiest thing to do. Boycott if we actually have other countries.
And eventually trying to oust Pakistan from SAARC or eventually wrapping up SAARC?
Forget SAARC. You know, wrapping up SAARC, there are lots of international associations today which exist in name. I mean, most recently we saw NAM, right?
Yeah.
What was NAM 30 years back? What is it today?
Yeah.
It's still there. People still meet. But its relevance has gone. SAARC's relevance is decreasing by the day. And I think we should simply allow it to fade away and build.
Before you cross the Air Marshal, Chief Marshal, may I say one thing?
Yes.
Pakistan is sabotaging SAARC from within.
Exactly.
It is not allowing new free trade agreements to come into economic union and so on. At the same time, we now have separate forums. We have a separate India, Nepal, Bhutan, Bangladesh quadrilateral. Mm. Which was used for
connecting. So you're saying increasingly just start
and
ignoring
BIMSTEC. The master move is for us to invite BIMSTEC to Goa.
Barkha, just 1 minute before others come in, because we keep constantly referring to Pakistan as a nuclear power, and you also mentioned that below the
conflict
nuclear
below the threshold.
I think we have to get rid of this mindset.
Absolutely.
You know, North Korea is a nuclear power. And yet you look at the relationship between South Korea and North Korea. Nobody is terrorized by the fact that North Korea is a nuclear power. And it is in a completely non-transparent.
But does it limit the military options?
No, we have to call the nuclear bluff. It does not. We called the bluff at the time of Kargil. I mean,
the Americans intervened. The Americans intervened because they believe the area was a nuclear
disaster.
That was not the reason. Nawaz went running to America crying uncle.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
And eventually the Americans mediated the safe passage deal for these intruders to withdraw.
But Americans intervene in order to show that they have a role in the region. Frankly, if we stand up to Pakistan, I cannot see Pakistan having a nuclear blackmail capability.
Okay, A. Marshall, and then I'll go back to the politicians. Yes.
Yeah.
What are we looking at today? You know, there's one point about covert ops, and I agree with both Shashi and Partha that these are not things that television journalists can determine, certainly. But the problem with covert ops for any government is that it's simultaneously trying to address public sentiment, right? And we've had people in government tell us, at least on background briefings, that this time we can't take the usual measures. People are really angry. There's a cumulative effect. Plus, they have their own past stated positions on how they're not going to be the Congress. So, if they do not want to be the Congress, what can we as a state
do? The Congress was not totally innocent on
I'll take that to Shashi. I'll take that. You know more than we do, Partha. But
Barkha, public sentiment and emotions are left to the politicians to handle.
Yes.
When you plan a response to a terror situation, as was in Uri, it is very different. It should never come in the way of planning overt, covert, economic or
so
diplomatic actions.
So they cannot guide
It cannot
military
be a
decisions.
Guideline to,
Absolutely.
To for your actions.
Yes.
Your actions have to be correct, sequential, and it's a whole of government approach. It is not this or that or that. Because each one is interdependent. Even if you say you want to strike Pakistan.
Would you prefer to see other options which are still within the diplomatic realm, whether it's abrogating treaties, whether it's recalling envoys, whether it's asking an envoy to leave, explored before a military option is even speculated on?
But that's how it's done. That's how it's normally done. Every other, it's not that it's a knee-jerk reaction that you stand up and you go and hit someone.
You know, everything complements each other.
Each other. It has to.
And that's how you
and
go
on the
about.
Indus Water Treaty, where do you weigh? Where do you weigh in on water? On the water treaty?
I agree with all of them what they said.
That it should not be
abrogated. It should not be. It should. I mean, if it is such a pressure that there is no other option left and you go to cut off that water, it's a different issue. But I don't think we've reached that stage yet.
Okay, I want to go back to Shashi and then Sudhanshu. And let's bring up also the juxtaposition, if we can, of what Burhan Wani's been saying and what Nawaz Sharif says about him in contrast. Shashi, talk a little bit about the Congress. What held you back? What holds back governments? You know, we're hearing again and again these days the age of strategic restraint is over. That restraint was something that the Congress used to proudly talk about. What guided that restraint, and do you believe that that age of restraint is over? And can we, while Shashi talks, stay on that graphic just for a bit? I want our viewers to look at those contrasting comments between Wani and Nawaz Sharif. Go ahead, Shashi.
Okay, I can't see your graphic, but and it wasn't in politics or in government when 2611 happened. But I supported the policy of restraint at that time because there were two major considerations. The first was that India's overwhelming priority is the development, prosperity, well-being of our own people. That requires foreign investment. Investors don't come into war zones. We should not, we should think very deeply before we plunge our country into a major military conflict because it will undermine our fundamental objectives of development. So that is the first and overriding consideration. The second, indeed, was that war might not actually resolve anything, and that the option that was exercised effectively of isolating Pakistan diplomatically and bringing to bear considerable pressure on it from its sponsors, patrons, aid givers, and so on, actually did work reasonably well for a few years. It resulted, for example, in the arrest of seven conspirators, Zakir Rahman, Lakhvi, and people. In the end, of course, as the pressure eased with time, the Pakistanis let these people go and we were back to square one. But the fact is, at that time, the choice of strategy was the right one and it actually
worked. What's changed today, Shashi?
Today, maybe
if it was right, then what's changed today? What has changed today? 2611 was as grave a provocation as any. It was an act of war. The attack on Pathankot saw a very different response. We have to be able to identify, is this just a country that's saying we've had enough, this is a cumulative response, or has something shifted? You have to be able to say if that restraint was right then, why isn't it right today? We need to understand that.
No, I think broadly speaking, it remains right in that war is not an option. But there are various actions and options short of war, some of which have been explored in this program, some of which are undoubtedly being considered behind closed doors in the government. And we hope to look at that. While we're talking about all this, let's also talk about what we've done wrong in our country, because Pathankot happened in January. It's a criminal shame that Uri was allowed to happen in September. The Campos Committee report on the protection of our defense installations has been sitting in the defense ministry since March, with no action taken. The government has to also ask itself where it failed. I think it's important that we can certainly take all sorts of actions on Pakistan, but let's also get our own act in order. There is enough technology available in the 21st century for us to have thermal imaging, infrared cameras, night vision, all sorts of equipment around the perimeters of every single defense installation in Kashmir, so that Uri and Pathankot never happen again. The fact that Pathankot was allowed to be repeated despite an extensive report having been submitted by a former vice chief of staff is, I think, criminal negligence on the part of this government. And they ought to really absolutely address this issue and make sure this never happens again. Not one more brave Jawan needlessly loses his life because of delays in the defense ministry.
Sudhanshu, I do want to bring you in because it is important also to understand a shift in Mr. Modi's and the government's own approach to Pakistan. It has long been my belief that Mr. Modi invested a lot of political capital in Pakistan instead of investing the same capital domestically within the Kashmir Valley. Whether it was a trip to meet Nawaz Sharif on his birthday, or whether, you know, it was just reaching out to Pakistan in multiple different ways. Even after Pathankot, you allowed contentiously Pakistani investigators, including the ISI, to come to the airbase in Pathankot. What has changed your mind? Is it the unrest that we have seen in Kashmir in the last 2 months? Why are we talking Balochistan today when we did not talk about it after Pathankot? Where has been that tipping point?
If you look at the Pathankot, it was having a distinct difference with the present incidents in Uri. Because immediately after Pathankot, the Prime Minister of Pakistan has talked to our Prime Minister. The NSA of Pakistan has talked to our NSA, and they have assured that they will act to the leads provided by the Indian government. So there was a little bit of a ray of hope, though it was quite bleak. But unfortunately, as it was expected, it has become a, finally, it has become a futile exercise. So, at this juncture, now, I think the time of restraint is gradually running out, because after Parliament attack in 2001, we have not done it. Even if go way back in 1990, the abduction of the daughter of then Home Minister, from there the things have gone gradually deteriorating. 2001, then 2011.
You're in alliance with the other daughter of that Home Minister. You're in alliance with that other daughter of the Home Minister. We're talking, of course, about Mehbooba Mufti. Your alliance agreement ideologically militates against a lot of your political positions.
That we projected ourselves as a soft state in the last two decades. But as soon as our government came, we have slightly changed the policy, at least on the diplomatic level. As G. Parth Sarthi ji has pointed out one thing, that if we do something, Pakistan can use it as a Muslim phenomena. But once we have raised the issue of Balochistan and Gilgistan, now Pakistan is slightly coming in a tightrope, because in Kashmir conflict they can put it as a Hindu-Muslim conflict. But what about Balochistan?
I will get into Balochistan in just a moment, Pakistan, and we'll bring up the shots of Mr. Bukti applying officially for
asylum. In my opinion, our policy was assertive, and we have slightly left the defensive aspect and gone on assertive aspect, and so will be the strategic policy in the time to come.
Air Chief Marshal Major, after 26/11, it is now known that you as Air Chief were willing to strike inside Pakistan if needed, and it was decided against. As a military person, do you believe that was the right decision?
You know, let's get the strike correct. We are not talking of a war. We are talking of a surgical strike to a identified target within POK at that time. It was not across the international boundary. Across international boundary is war.
But it was across the LOC, in what the Indian Parliament holds to be our territory.
I will not go into those details. But what all I can say is, the contingency plans were ready.
Yes.
Not just us, including the other two services. And the services even today have contingency plans ready for such operations.
What decided against it?
That is left to the government. I wouldn't be able to answer that question. Because, ironically, the intent is always with the government, never with the armed forces. The armed forces have to execute the task. And there is no way I would know as to why the decision was taken not to strike.
Do you believe it was, as Shashi argues, the correct decision at that time? Or do you believe it was a mistake?
See, in any such incident, whether it's 26/11, whether it is Uri, the decision for punishment, for military punishment in whatever form, covert, overt, has to be done immediately. But to do that is a dilemma for the government, for any government.
Present, and you past, sense that that is the dilemma this government is facing too?
Every government will face. It's not.
And why does it have to be immediate? Before I get Shashi to respond to what you said, why does it have to be immediate?
Because if you do it a month later, I'm not talking of I'm talking of basic punishment. Okay, listen, we are capable. We have a credible armed force here. You do this next time, we will hit you.
Shashi, I do want to bring you in. Then I want Sanjay, because he's worked closely with Manmohan Singh, to also come in. Do you acknowledge that this is a government with a very distinctly different approach to Pakistan than that of the Congress?
I'm not sure that we know what this government's approach is to Pakistan, Barkha, because it's been so completely incoherent. We've seen so many ups and downs, more than a child's yo-yo, as I once said. The fact is that we have to now get a coherent vision from the Prime Minister. He ought to share with the nation, take the nation and the opposition into confidence as to what his vision is. I think that we've seen everything. We've seen criticism, hostility, artillery exchanges. We've seen silk and shawl exchanges. We've seen a birthday visit to Nawaz Sharif at Christmas time, NSA meetings, foreign secretary meetings being cancelled. Every example you can find is contradictory. Now we seem to be settling into a clearer pattern, and if there is a distinctive BJP policy that is going to be different from everyone else, it remains to be seen. But let me make a larger point. I have always believed very profoundly that when it comes to foreign policy, there really isn't a Congress policy and a BJP policy. There is an Indian foreign policy. It is ultimately our national interest that we all stand behind. The people who are custodians of the national interest in power, we tend to trust their judgment, we back them. The Congress Party was completely supportive of the government, the way it chose to prosecute the Kargil War, And the same thing will happen in any future conflict, whoever is in power, I believe. Having said that, we do believe that the government must show some clarity of vision and purpose. That clarity has been notably absent on Pakistan for 2.5 years. And as far as some of the internal accountabilities are concerned, such as the failure to protect our own installations so that the Pathankot was not repeated in Uri, there too there is a level of accountability that the opposition is right in demanding.
Okay.
Having said that, we are one country, and when we are attacked from outside, we will remain one always.
Now, before Sudhanshu Trivedi comes in, and we will also get brief comments from Pakistan, where we're joined by a PMLN representative, Sanjay Baru, do you agree that there isn't a Congress and a BJP policy on Pakistan? Because Pakistan is one of the most politicized conversations in our national politics. There's no getting away from that. You did work with the Prime Minister who was accused of romanticizing Pakistan. Mr. Modi was meant to be different. Do you see that difference?
You know, one of Dr. Manmohan Singh's famous quotes was, do not judge a political party by what it says in opposition, but by what it does in government, right? Mm-hmm. So every party, whatever it says when it's in opposition, it's what they do in government that counts. Second, India-Pakistan relationship is as much about foreign policy as it's about domestic politics.
Yeah.
You know, we cannot run away from that. And the domestic political situation in both countries shapes the bilateral relationship. And that situation changes.
So do you sense a distinction?
Of course there's a distinction. But the distinction is not just because they're two different political parties. The distinction is also because the contexts are changing. Mm. The fact is that when...
Why is the context different? Is the context
only
of 2611 and Uri different?
No, no. 2611 was UPA 2. I can't talk about that. But UPA 1, when the Manmohan Singh Musharraf dialogue was happening, the global context was one in which at least Musharraf felt compelled to have that dialogue with Dr. Manmohan Singh. That dialogue finally didn't go anywhere when Musharraf himself lost power.
Yeah.
So the internal politics of Pakistan actually ended that dialogue. It was not an international environment or the bilateral relationship that ended that dialogue, but the internal politics of Pakistan when Musharraf was ousted, right? Yeah. And again here, Dr. Manmohan Singh lost public support in the second part of UPA 2 once all these corruption scams came up. Therefore, his ability to push for in UPA 2 was much weaker.
But do you agree with Shashi that there's an absence of consistency, or is no party able to be consistent with Pakistan?
Exactly. That's the point I'm trying to make, that you are looking for consistency in an issue in which consistency is not possible because the parameters involved are so varied. For example, the international context. Yeah. China was not such an important backer of Pakistan 10 years ago as it is today. The China-Pakistan axis has become stronger. And the United States is finding itself, you know, at a...
So let me get Sudhanshu, and then I'll take this point to Ambassador Parsa-Sarthi. We do have to go across to Lahore or Islamabad. Which one is it? To Pakistan as well. Sudhanshu Trivedi, on this point of Shashi, that there's an absence of internal clarity, who does the BJP want to be? Do you want to be the hawk? Do you want to be the dove? Do you want to be a bit of both on Pakistan?
I would like to differ with what Dr. Shashi Tharoor had said, because our policy is categorically clear. Our policy is there cannot be talk and terror together, can only be talk on terror. And up till now in 2.5 years, there are only two official engagement with the Pakistan. One was at the level of Prime Minister at UFA, in which there was a clear categorical statement on terrorism. And second was NSA level talk in Bangkok. That was precisely on terror. On any other aspect, we refuse to talk to Pakistan. And if you look at the diplomatic aspect, we managed to isolate Pakistan by and large on this issue. Today, except China, no country is taking the side of Pakistan. Even US is snubbing them. Even UAE and Saudi Arabia are not taking their side. In the recently concluded SAR summit, the two major Muslim countries of the region, Afghanistan and Bangladesh, has openly taken a stand against Pakistan. So in my opinion, we are successful that we will only talk on terror and making a terror an issue. And also, I would again like to point out that raising the issue of Balochistan and Kashmir has also diluted that Pakistan stand of Hindu versus Muslim conflict.
Okay.
Because these are all the within the Pakistan.
Okay, before I do go across to Daniel Aziz, the PMLN representative who's on the program, Ambassador Parthasarathy, a Pakistani journalist who must remain unnamed, who's a friend of mine, sent me a message from New York, and she said, what did you think of the Nawaz Sharif's speech? And I said that I think with his endorsement of Burhan Mani, he scored a massive self-goal, because there is no global appetite anymore for this kind of support for armed jihadists. to which she said, if he'd said anything less than this, he would have been chewed up at home. He may have bought himself one more month of peace with this speech. So to talk to Dr. Baru's point, to speak to his point that domestic politics at home does impact what leaders can do. Is that what's happening with Nawaz Sharif here?
Look,
Chief retires.
Sorry, when the other Sharif retires or gets an extension as the case may be.
No, let us be very clear. Right now, Nawaz has no powers. The army mounts major military operations in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, in which 800,000 people are displaced, 200,000 troops are employed, and there is an inflow of Pashtuns for the first time back into Afghanistan.
Hmm.
The army does that without parliamentary approval, without Nawaz's approval.
Yeah.
The army does precious much what it wants, and there is nothing Nawaz can do about it. The army has struck a good alliance with the likes of Imran Khan.
Yeah.
And they're capable of making like, and Tahirul Qadri.
But you know, there's one view in India that used to say you have to strengthen Nawaz Sharif. There is one view, I don't believe in
strength. If a fellow can't strengthen himself, he shouldn't strengthen himself on Indian crutches. I wouldn't want to have an Indian Prime Minister strengthened on Pakistani crutches.
So can I just get a response
just
from
one,
Pakistan?
One last point.
Yes.
So let's be clear. Nawaz was singing Rahil's tune. He had to. His family is facing corruption charges. The army is turning the screws. Tahirul Qadri is turning the screws. People want investigations. He is in a bind. And there is, I am afraid he's a lame duck. And let's see what happens if Rahil Sharif's successor is slightly more considerate than Rahil Sharif.
Or Rahil himself changes his mind.
Okay, Daniel Aziz, let's say up front that we aren't going to agree on any fundamentals on this program. So before this descends into a tutu meme, let me ask you the core question that most Indians would want to know. How does a prime minister of a country support a recognized terrorist who is on tape? Before you joined this program and you were a little late, we played excerpts for that tape where he actually calls for a khilafat or a caliphate in Kashmir, and he asks boys to pick up the gun and join jihad. I think that age has long passed, and Pakistan, it's unprecedented even for Pakistan to stand up at the UN and actually call this terrorist a peaceful protester. We have had dialogues on Kashmir in the past. We even had a Musharraf Manmohan kind of four-point formula that was on the works in the back channel. We all know that. The problem is not about talking about Kashmir. The problem is endorsing terror, Mr. Aziz.
Well, I think that the uprising in Kashmir is well known, as well as the role and the history of Kashmiri people who have tried for their right of self-determination. And ultimately, this has led to violence on both sides. And to continue to detail that out is not going to change anything on your program. However, for your audience,
you are supporting a man calling for jihad surrounded by 11 men holding AK-47s all around him. This is not street protests or civilian protests or even the Hurriyat. This is not even separatists. This is terrorism. This is the Hizbul Mujahideen whose chief sits in your country.
We are supporting the due process of law, the right to fair trial, rather than some kind of extrajudicial process resulting in what can be called murder. So that having been said,
where is the due process of law before we move on to where our countries can go from here, Mr. Aziz? You know, I have covered Kashmir for 20 years. I am sometimes accused of being far too soft-hearted on Kashmir because I do highlight issues of political alienation that I believe are between Delhi and Srinagar to resolve. There can be, however, no support for the use of violence and terrorism to make a political point. That militates against all global norms.
Well, that's exactly the point that should be communicated to the Indian security forces in Kashmir. But that having been said,
see, this illustrates why this dialogue can get nowhere between
our
countries.
And the message, madam, if you're going to keep interrupting, I won't be able to give even one sentence.
I want to ask you, where do we go from here? Because we're not going to agree on Kashmir.
Please. Well, I'm not talking. I'm trying to tell you something else, if you can listen for a moment.
Sure, go ahead.
Instead of being hobbled by Pakistan and not being able to see beyond that, just raise your eyes and look a little bit to the west. See what's happening in Syria. See what's happening in Yemen. See what's happening in Afghanistan. See the bombings in France. See the bombings in Brussels. See the bombings in Canada and US, other places. Please try and understand this is not a Pakistan problem.
And yet here you are supporting the call for a pan-Islamist caliphate.
Look, if you're not going to allow me to finish the sentence, I'm not going to remain on your program.
You can finish the sentence, but you do have to answer the questions.
Okay, thank you. Don't interrupt, please. Let me answer the question.
Go ahead.
What I'm trying to explain to you is that this is a much broader problem. And Pakistan, its own cantonments have been attacked. Its own GHQ has been attacked. Its own Navy has been attacked. Its own Air Force installations have been attacked. The evidence that you have on the current attack that took place in Nuri, your own investigation agency has stated that there were no Pakistani signature.
It has stated nothing of the kind.
Which is contrary to what your general was saying.
It has stated nothing of the kind. I'm sorry, it has stated nothing of the kind.
It has absolutely stated nothing of the kind. It's in the front pages.
Not at all.
Oh my God.
Not at all.
Can I please get
it's on the front pages of the Pakistani media.
Is this how you want to conduct the interview?
Mr. Aziz, I am among the most polite Indians you'll find on television. I can tell you that. Yes. Try another channel
That's
and you'll
fine.
See what the mood is here.
Let me put it to you like this. I don't need to try channels. I've come here to give a comment. If you're going to allow me to give a comment,
I am now allowing you a comment.
I can do that. Otherwise, you shouldn't invite me.
Mr. Aziz, I need to get reactions.
No, you're not allowing me to finish.
No, but I can't allow you an unfettered space to absolutely propaganda.
Then it's not fair.
I cannot
then
allow
not
you to do propaganda.
You
I cannot
interrupt
allow you
anybody
to do propaganda.
Else.
I'm sorry. Because you
I'm
are claiming,
not doing propaganda.
You are claiming
I'm
that our agencies
facts.
Have denied Pakistani involvement
facts.
When our foreign secretary has called
yes.
your envoy
yes.
and placed...
And you ask
one
your,
minute.
You
and
ask
offered
your embassy
DNA
here. It's on the front page of all the newspapers.
So this is what any India-Pakistan conversation descends into. And this is what makes me believe... Mr. Aziz,
because
now
you're
let
making
me get
it
a word in.
Into that.
Now let me get a word
and
in.
You're not willing to listen.
Now let me get a word in.
No, you
I've
haven't
heard
let
you.
Me finish.
I have
you
heard
haven't
you.
Let me. What
no,
do you mean
I'm
now?
Sorry,
oh, you've been talking the whole time. You haven't heard me. And this
I
is the problem
you.
With you
I
that you're not willing
you.
To listen.
You.
No, you're not willing to listen.
No, I will have to.
And the point I'm trying to make.
I will have to move on. I will have to move on.
You're welcome to move on. You're welcome to move on.
You're
welcome to move on.
You're
welcome to move on.
All right, I will move on. I will move on because let me get reactions to what you've said so far. And this to me, let's take this to Ambassador.
I haven't said anything so far.
Hang on. I think you've said a lot. I think you've said a lot. I think you've actually said a lot. And I think what's very clear in the signs emanating from Pakistan is that there is no attempt even at de-escalation, at bringing down friction. It is not pleasurable for anybody to shout at anybody else. It's certainly not for my kind of television hosting. But this is what every attempt at a reasonable conversation gets locked into.
No, let me make it clear. Mr. Aziz, Daniel Aziz, is a member of the Pakistan Muslim League.
Yes.
Now, the fact of the matter is that it is not India which is saying they're a terrorist country. You travel to the United States, there is a resolution of the US Congress to have them declared as a terrorist state.
By
it's unprecedented.
Yeah.
By a joker.
Second, please.
By a joker named Dana Rohrabacher.
Mr. Aziz, I did you the courtesy of not interfering with you.
He also wanted to split up Afghanistan.
Second, talk to the Afghans. Talk to the Bangladeshis. What do they say?
Yeah.
That Pakistan is the epicenter of terrorism and throw them out of South Asia. These are the words of the Afghans and the Bangladeshis, not me. I don't think they're going to remain in SAR too long. That's another matter. The fact of the matter is they're in denial. Now, they should ask themselves, how is it that if you go to the United States, the San Bernardino terrorists are from Pakistan. This recent guy goes to Quetta, gets radicalized. Why? Because the Quetta Shura is there, backed by the ISI. These are all emerging. Then there's another fellow, Shahzad, an Marshal's son, goes and shoots up the Times Square. Where does it end? Osama bin Laden ultimately lands up in Abbottabad, produces four children, has four wives. He's located next to the Pakistan Military Academy. Lo and behold, the Pakistanis didn't know he was there for 10 years in a cantonment next to the Pakistan Military Academy. Yeah. I mean, it's a joke. So I earlier enunciated the world reaction. I don't care what the Pakistanis say. I know the world is with me now.
Okay, let's take last comments on where we go from here. Mr. Aziz, you've joined the program late, so in fact we're going to lose the link to you in a minute. So let me just get a word from you. Where do you believe Mr. Sharif can assert his power when the perception is widely not, and this is quoted to me by Pakistani friends, that he actually asserts no authority anymore? There's no autonomy of authority left with him.
I think that's a very unfortunate comment because it's not based in reality at all. There may be some sections of opposition and others who like to promote that point of view. You can take that at face value if that's helpful to you. It has nothing to do with reality. What I can tell you is that after 52 countries of ISAF have spent 15 years in Afghanistan and trillions of dollars, the situation is where it is. So if you think that this is a problem that we can just wish away by whipping Pakistan, then okay. I think it's a very short-sighted approach that India has.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Let's take your comments all around and take last comments. Sudhanshu Trivedi.
I just want to say to our representative from Pakistan just two facts. In U.S. State Department, Pakistan is dealt with South Asia. But in U.S. Defense Department, that is Pentagon, it is dealt with Central Asia. It means you have gone yourself in the league of Iraq and Afghanistan. And second, there are media reports that in the recently concluded G20 summit in Hangzhou, in China, there was an undeclared instruction to the hotels that for five countries, that is Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq and Turkey, no citizen should be allowed to stay in the hotels of Hangzhou. Hmm. These are the real facts of one of your more trusted allies like US and China.
Okay. All right.
This shows the real face, like just one sentence, that whenever, why it happens that the multinationals of US come to India for talent hunt, and okay. the armies of U.S. goes to Pakistan for terrorist hunt.
Okay, quickly,
they
Sanjay.
Should try to understand this.
Sanjay.
Well, I think, you know, frankly, we have waited very patiently over the years for a reasonable response from Pakistan to our concerns. I don't see that forthcoming. I would say that the way in which the rest of Asia treats North Korea, the way in which South Korea deals with North Korea, is more or less the way we need to deal with Pakistan. I think even the media, Barkha, we need to reduce our obsession with Pakistan. There's a lot of South Asia, a lot of Asia apart from Pakistan. We have been far too obsessed about Pakistan. I think we need to live through a period in which our dealings with Pakistan would be minimal.
Very much.
Barkha, having heard all the very talented panelists here who are experts in their own subjects, all I have to say is that handling a situation like this or in the past or in the future is a whole of government approach.
Yeah.
And as a military man, let me tell you that the armed forces in India today, you know, after all, you have the third largest army, the fourth largest air force, and the seventh largest navy. Now these are standing armed forces, they are not reservists. And with this kind of a capability, I mean, the critics and others may say anything that there are shortages. Every damn armed force in the world has some shortages. That is not the issue. But when it comes to capability, and when we see this capability vis-a-vis Pakistan, the country should never, ever hesitate and think that the armed forces are wanting in their tasks. It's as simple as that.
Shashi, you can have the last word.
No, I just think that obviously we are all looking forward to seeing the situation being dealt with maturely and responsibly. Whatever the government does, I hope it contemplates very carefully the consequences of each step it may take and is prepared to react to those consequences as well, so we don't see a knee-jerk reaction. As far as internal procedures and accountabilities are concerned, I hope we will be able to take effective and rapid steps to ensure the security of the perimeters of every Indian defense installation in Kashmir and perhaps beyond, so that we never again have to suffer the horrors and losses we've suffered in Uri and Pathankot this year. Let us, in that spirit, also try and have more of a dialogue within government and opposition so that we have a united front in facing these challenges. I think there's a consensus in this discussion that nothing much is going to be gained by talking with Pakistan. As far as SAARC is concerned, which has been mentioned, we do need to ask ourselves what we hoped to gain out of SAARC in the past, whether those objectives have simply to be thrown aside, or whether there is a case for temporary suspensions rather than a longer-term expulsion of Pakistan from that organization. There's a lot that needs to be thought through and worked, but the fact is we are not short of options.
All right, we will leave it there. The SAARC debate, I don't want to reopen it at the end of the program. I think what we also do need to remember is that when we speak of soldiers that die in operations, that get martyred as they did in Uri, that even now are in the midst of ongoing encounters, we forget that these are actually real flesh and blood people who actually leave families behind. Yesterday we reminded you of the children that they leave behind, and all of the heartbreaking images have actually been every single day of children. Children who are really, in a sense, dealing with an interrupted childhood, having to grow up much too soon, having to salute by the side of a coffin. And this is the most recent tragic casualty that we have seen coming out of Jammu and Kashmir. This is Havildar Madan Lal, who has been killed in operations in Nogam, where that encounter in the Kashmir Valley is still on, leaving behind a daughter, Shweta, who's 6 years old, and a son who is only 2 years old. Let that image stay with you tonight. We'll see you tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Thank you for watching. Goodbye.